Welcome to episode 21 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
And I'm your other host, Paul Bowers. Jace, do you have a time period or a piece of history that you're obsessed with and always thinking about? Like, you know, some guys, it's the Roman Empire. It's like once a day, at least, it's on their mind. Do you have a Roman Empire or like a historical time period that you find yourself casting back to?
I feel like I've inherited a Roman Empire from my 10-year-old. So they're in school, right? And they're learning all about the American Revolution and the Revolutionary War. And so we've brought that energy home. And each night we've been reading books together. What was the Declaration of Independence? What was the Constitution? What was the Statue of Liberty? And so we've just been really digging into the formation of this country, which has been nice to revisit through a 10-year-old's eyes, especially when you're as jaded as I am. So yeah, I guess that became my Roman Empire. At least it has been kind of over the past, you know, few months. What about you? Except I'm asking this as if I don't know already what your time period is. I do know what it is, but just tell us, Paul.
Well, first of all, I love that. I think that's a beautiful way to revisit history with fresh eyes. But yeah, you know me, Jace. It's Reconstruction. It's specifically South Carolina Reconstruction after the Civil War. You know, it's a time period where our state, like other southern states, was being readmitted into the Union and building for the first time something approaching a democratic society. And I just think my obsession kind of springs from the idea that this was just like a really radical window of possibility where things changed rapidly. There was just this rapid expansion of rights and of democratic representation. And I know it ended poorly, but I think about it all the time. And I think about what could have been, and I think about how we might learn some lessons from that time.
You know, Paul, it's very on brand that you love history. It's very on brand that you haven't just studied Reconstruction throughout the entire region, but you really have honed in on South Carolina because you're such a South Carolina history buff. So I love that you have
here.
This.
I'm never leaving.
Yeah. That's right. I love that you have this obsession, and I am not at all shocked that you have brought this obsession into the While I Breathe podcast. I mean, it's classic Paul Bowers. I love it.
Yeah. If you'll indulge me today, this is going to be an episode that is heavy on Reconstruction history and featuring someone who's actually an expert and not just like an amateur, you know, who's read two books like me. So our guest today is someone I've been wanting to have on the show for a while, finally found the occasion to do it. This is Dr. Robert Greene II. He's a historian, and he's an assistant professor at Claflin University in Orangeburg, South Carolina. And his work and his writing are in large part responsible for my amateurish obsession with Reconstruction. And I think it's just, it's brilliant. You know, his work is really accessible and thoughtful. And I'm so excited to share this conversation with the world.
Now, I'm excited to hear from him and to give you this fanboy opportunity. I love it. Let's do it.
I know. Making my dreams come true here, Jace. Let's start with this. Dr. Greene, you were saying that you grew up just across the river in Augusta, Georgia, and then came to South Carolina and feel like maybe you didn't get the full scope of South Carolina history growing up. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, sure. And first off, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm actually a big fan of it and glad to be on it. And in terms of what I learned about South Carolina growing up in Georgia was very little. In fact, I would tell you that I barely learned much about Georgia's history, to be honest with you. The big thing we always emphasized was, of course, Sherman's March to the Sea in 1864, 65. And this is actually a good place for me to talk about how little I learned about South Carolina, because in Georgia, it was always Sherman makes it to Savannah, and then that's about it. And yet we all know that actually Sherman's army then makes a turn north in the South Carolina. And this is a state where I think it could be said they had a lot of fun in 1865, to say the least. In fact, I do recall...
One way to put it, yeah. In Columbia, you mean?
Yes, I do joke because one of my other hats that I wear is I'm a lead instructor for the Majeska Simpkin School of Human Rights for the South Carolina Progressive Network. And just the other day, I joked that Sherman's army or the retreated Confederates, whichever story you believe, made Columbia, quote unquote, famously hot. That's the slogan of the city. So I think it's rather indicative of how little even different southern states know about each other's histories, much less their own.
Right. Yeah, I think it's been long enough you can make that joke. They have moved on from the famously hot slogan, but it's the one everybody remembers.
Right.
Well, I should give you a proper introduction. This is Dr. Robert Green II, professor at Claflin University, leader in the Majeska Simpkin School, and a really thoughtful historian and writer. I've really appreciated your work over the years. I get a lot of insight and inspiration from it. I think, people read history for different reasons, but I think you contextualize it in a way that really highlights why it matters today, why South Carolina's history in particular is so rich and radical and so different from what I learned growing up. I guess my background, I was born and raised in South Carolina, and there are gaps in my South Carolina history education that I'm still filling in today. I wanted to talk about the New South and the Old South. And usually we do this at the end of an episode. We'll ask you if you have anything to plug, but I know you have your own podcast that's called Our New South. I've started listening to it. Really, really appreciate it. You get some great interview subjects on there. And let's talk about the New South first, because that's something I had a really vague understanding of growing up. To me, it was always like, you know, Charlotte, Atlanta, that's the New South. And so, you know, I had like a vague understanding that there was an Old South and there is a New South. There are maybe some things that didn't change in between. What do you mean when you say the New South? What does that really mean?
You know, it's funny you should ask that question because, as you know, listening to the Our New South podcast, we ask all of our guests that same question.
Yeah, and, yeah, I'm putting it to you now.
I'll give you two short answers, one as a historian and one as a Southerner. As a historian, the phrase New South is something that the South has recycled since the end of Reconstruction. Every generation says, we're a New South, we're moving on from our mistakes of the past. The first New South was in the 1880s, when boosters and journalists like Henry Grady were making a case that the South was open for business after the Civil War, after Reconstruction. We had moved on from slavery. We were now open for business to the entire world, with the caveat, of course, that that New South was still going to be as racist as all the previous iterations of the South. And this is actually, I think, where the New South definition gets tricky, because every generation will say we're a New South. But up until the 1960s and 70s, it was always with the assumption of we're still going to keep white supremacy in place. We might moderate it. We might make it a bit more palatable, but we're going to still keep that in place. Since the 60s and 70s, the New South ideal has been, like you just said, Charlotte, Atlanta, the growing places like, for example, the resurgence of Birmingham or Montgomery, places like that. Or even I would add Columbia as an example of this too. Cities that promote themselves as being progressive on issues of race, but at the same time being very pro-business, being friendly to low taxes, things like that. So that's my historian's hat. As a Southerner, I think what the New South should mean, and I think what it means for a lot of folks now, is a region that is finally grappling with its past in an honest and forthright manner. That we're not going to just run away from the fact that we had slavery here, we had Jim Crow segregation here, but that we're going to say these are things that help define what the South has been, but they are not things the South shall be trapped by, that we can understand this history and utilize it to make a better South for everyone, not just old white men, but for everyone in the South, whether you're black, white, Hispanic, Asian, gay, straight, trans, et cetera. It's a South that is really embracing the best of itself while not forgetting the worst of itself at the same time.
I love that. That is, I mean, you put it better than I would, but that is more or less what I think of when I hear the New South. That is what we could be. There's a recent episode of your podcast where you interviewed Daniel Suarez, who was if I remember this right, the first Mexican-born NASCAR driver to win a Cup Series race. And he talked about immigrating to the U.S., coming to Charlotte for the first time, some of the culture shock. But that just seems like such a great example of NASCAR, which is maybe the quintessential Southern sport. And somebody coming as an immigrant and using that sport as a way to either assimilate or to assert himself in this region. And I just thought he had some really interesting insights, about what it meant to come here. And man, I'm not a huge NASCAR fan, but I grew up near a lower level track in Somerville, the Somerville Speedway, and so that really hit close to home for me hearing that story.
Well, and I grew up not being a NASCAR fan, but being aware of it, because in the 1990s, if you were in the South, NASCAR was just everywhere. And I can even recall where I was when I learned Dale Earnhardt died. I actually remember that. And so I think you're absolutely right. There are some aspects of the South that are interesting to see from the point of view of an immigrant or from someone who's not native to the region.
Well, I had you on to talk about a time before NASCAR, before our living memories, but Reconstruction. I am just constantly peppering and probably annoying my coworkers and family with trivia about Reconstruction. Like, I brought this up in a staff meeting the other day. Which state had the first black justice on its state Supreme Court? South Carolina. It was Jonathan Jasper Wright in 1870. And speaking of things we didn't learn in school, that is a part of our history, and it's a complicated one, and it was a short-lived period. But I was wondering if we could start with just a really basic definition here. What do you mean when you say Reconstruction?
Wow. Well, that is, I think, one of the best questions I've ever received, because I think it's assumed these days that everyone knows what you're talking about, but they really
I never
don't.
Assume that. Yeah.
Well, that's probably a smart idea. Doubly so if you're on social media. But with Reconstruction, the basic definition is Reconstruction was an era in American history where the federal government was trying to figure out how do we reincorporate the Southern states into the Union after the Civil War. That is the very basic definition of it. But once you start thinking about that for more than 5 seconds, the natural follow-up question is, well, how do you do that without dealing with the 4 million men, women, and children who've been freed from bondage at the end of the Civil War? How do you deal with the fact that there were still plenty of former Confederates running around, whether they were generals, politicians, or even common soldiers, who were not happy about the outcome of the Civil War? So on a very basic level, it's about reincorporating those Southern states. But it was a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, I know in South Carolina during that time period, our state was sending former Confederate leaders to Congress, but it was also electing a majority black legislature in the state. It was a really complicated time. In some ways, a period of really rapid liberation. As I started reading about this time, there were just figures that really captivated me. And history is not about great men, but there are some people who are just characters that I think about a lot. Jonathan Jasper Wright, Richard Kane, who was a pastor at Emmanuel AME, also worked in news. Dear to my heart as a former news guy. He helped write our new state constitution. Robert Smalls, that man's life is, his story could be multiple movies if we wanted it to be. Is there a figure who you think about as really an important you know, a key to understanding that time period. Like if there's one person's story that you would sort of share to illustrate what it was like.
You know, you've mentioned several worthy candidates, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Jonathan Jasper Wright, in addition to being the first Black justice here in South Carolina, he later led the briefly in being Claflin University Law School that we had in the 1880s. It was actually based in Charleston. But I think if I were to choose one person, and goodness, you know, Robert Small's his story could be an action movie or a Netflix prestige series. There's a Defiant, the Robert Small's graphic novel that's out now. But I would actually choose Robert Elliott, who, and again, I say this as a fellow Robert, I think in our pantheon of South Carolina Roberts, Smalls kind of occupies this large space, but Elliott was a congressman in the mid-1870s. And the reason I think he should be remembered better is that he actually led the floor fight in the U.S. House for the 1875 Civil Rights Act. That was the last civil rights bill passed by Congress until 1957. And in that debate, at one point, Robert Elliott faces off with Alexander Stevens. Now, for your listeners, if they've heard that name before, if they're from Georgia, they probably know who he is. But I would go ahead and just say this. Stevens is best known for two things. He was a congressman from Georgia before the Civil War and after it. But during the war, he just happened to be the vice president of the Confederacy. So imagine this, right? Alexander Stevens helped lead the Confederate war effort as vice president. In 1861, he gives this infamous cornerstone speech where he argues that the Confederacy is the first government in history built upon this basic fact of white supremacy. He even repudiates Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence in this speech. And now in 1874, you have a Black man, Robert Elliott, from South Carolina, debating Alexander Stevens on the floor of the House about the Civil Rights Act of 1875. And it's really the last hurrah of Reconstruction. That's the last time the Republican Party really rallies behind civil rights. What eventually happens, of course, is that bill is overturned by the Supreme Court, which argues that it went too far in pursuing public accommodations for all and so forth. But I think Elliott's story is one that's really important because in his speech on the floor of the House, he says, there was one group in the South that was loyal to the Union. That was Black Americans. The least we can do is to treat them as equal citizens under the Constitution.
Yeah, that's, I'm just trying to imagine the whiplash of you know, maybe from Stevens' perspective, being a leader in this army upholding the institution of slavery, and then suddenly face to face with a member of the Black intelligentsia who had some things to say to him. That's just, yeah, in the space of a decade, what a radical shift.
I mean, it is actually remarkable when we think about Reconstruction. Think about it like this for a second. I always tell my students at Claflin in particular, imagine you were a person who was, and my students are often 18 and 21 years old. I would say to them, imagine you were 18 or 21 in 1865, and you have been born into slavery in Orangeburg. If you were a Black man, within a handful of years, you would have gone from being enslaved to not only having the right to vote, but actually voting for people who look just like you, going to the state house and even going to the U.S. Congress. That's incredible if you think about it.
Well, this story is better told elsewhere, but the Robert Small story is, you know, the story of a man who liberated himself and his family from slavery during the war, commandeered a Confederate steamship, took it out to the harbor, and then fought for the Union, came back after the war, helped rewrite our Constitution, helped make sure that we had public schools for all, reshaped our state, helped found the South Carolina Republican Party, and then went on to serve in Congress. And what a life. You know, I think history is more than individual stories, but to see that change in your lifetime, I can't imagine what it felt like for him.
It reminds me of the fact that the historian Darrell Scott has often referred to that generation of Black men and women as the Black version of the greatest generation. That you think about what they all endured going from slavery to freedom to being an integral part of American democracy. You just mentioned yourself, the work that those men, including Smalls and others, did on the 1868 South Carolina Constitution was nothing short of revolutionary. I mean, even to give you another example of this really quickly, one of my favorite historians, Lerone Bennett, who wrote for Ebony Magazine for many years, in 1965, he began a series of essays called Black Power. And that's before the Black Power movement formally kicks off. And some even argue they got their name from these series of essays. But his essays are about the Reconstruction period. And the very first one that was in the November 1965 issue of Ebony, it starts off like this. I just want to read a couple of lines. He wrote, "When the first Bastille fell, some men walked the streets of Paris totally unaware of the new thing that had moved in the womb of the human spirit. It was the same we were told in the streets of Boston when Minutemen in nearby Lexington fired certain shots that were heard in distant places. As it was in Paris and Boston in the 18th century, so it was in Charleston, South Carolina, on the day in the 19th century when the first official Western assembly with a black majority held its first session." That's how he describes the creation of the 1868 Constitution here in South Carolina. He's comparing it to the American and French revolutions. And when you think about what actually happened, that is an exaggeration.
The writing there, man, I'm thinking about that line, something moving in the womb of the human spirit, right? That, gosh, nobody writes right. like that anymore. But it's like a quickening. Like there's a something that is being felt that is something new waiting to be born. And I think a lot about the 1868 South Carolina Constitution. And in my job here, you know, we are often appealing to the U.S. Constitution. Obviously, we, you know, a lot of our cases involve the Bill of Rights, but there are cases at the ACLU of South Carolina that appeal to the state constitution. And some of the most important freedoms we enjoy today go back to that 1868 rewrite. You know, the right to a speedy redress of grievances, public schools for all. They abolished debtors' prisons at that time. I was reading, I mentioned Eric Foner earlier, I think. I haven't read, because I'm not a real historian, I haven't read his full history of Reconstruction, but the short history, I can read that as a layperson. It makes sense to me. I promise, listeners, it's not a dry read. I really couldn't put it down. There's a section where Foner, the historian, is talking about how radical South Carolina was at this time. And he wrote, "In South Carolina, radicalism was triumphant in 1867. In March, a Charleston Republican convention dominated by the city's freeborn blacks adopted a program for sweeping change in nearly every aspect of the state's life." I think radical, as I understand it at the time, it was more like an epithet. This was like published in white-owned newspapers in sort of a dismissive way, or like a way that suggested this was menacing. Today, we might see it in more of a positive light. This was radical in that rights were being expanded very quickly. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what was so radical about South Carolina and why. I mean, of all the states, why was South Carolina so radical at this time?
Well, there are a few reasons that the state is so radical. The biggest reason being that it was the only southern state that had a majority black population. We can't lose sight of that. I think it's very easy for us to fall into the trap that was set by historians after Reconstruction ended in the Dunning School, where they kind of portrayed Reconstruction as being a disaster because all these states were being run by black people. So I actually know the only state that actually you could say had, again, a black government was South Carolina. And even then, that's with a lot of caveats. Never had a black governor, for example. The state legislature was majority black in the lower house, but the upper Senate was still majority white, so on and so forth. But with that said, having a majority black population made a big difference, number one. Number two, it was very radical because it was a state that out of all the southern states was probably crying out the most for lasting change, even before the Civil War. Think about some of the things that happened with this new constitution. The creation of a universal public school system that had never been the case in the Palmetto State up to that point. The acceptance of no-fault divorce. And in fact, one of the things that's kind of downplayed about Reconstruction in that time period is the debate over women's rights that's going on, including in South Carolina. There was actually at one point a serious discussion about trying to grant women the right to vote in the state. That, again, didn't really go anywhere. But for listeners, think about what's going on in the country. You've got Reconstruction, but you've also got 20 years since Seneca Falls. You've got the women's rights movement trying to push for suffrage during the 1860s, but falling just short. But going back to South Carolina for a moment, you have this real moment of opportunity, especially after 1867. Again, the timing is important here. The U.S. Congress passes the Reconstruction Act of 1867, which basically tells Southern states, if you want to formally be readmitted to the Union, you're going to have to write new constitutions that, amongst other things, grant Black men the right to vote. That changes everything in the South, but doubly so in South Carolina. And so this state becomes a radical example of lasting change because of that majority Black population, because of the fact that the state's political apparatus is in flux after the Civil War. And there is a real sense that the state has a lot of catching up to do after the Civil War is over with, and the fact that slavery has been destroyed. Of course, again, this only lasts a few years, but it's still remarkable in its impact on the state even today.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that it was a rapid expansion of democracy, that we were suddenly making this huge leap toward actually being something like a representative democracy. Long way to go still, but it was this really rapid expansion. And I hadn't thought about that, the expansion of women's rights as well, that, you know, this was a time when Black voters suddenly won the franchise, but as a result, broader groups of people had their freedoms expanded. It was a rapid expansion of freedom for everybody. I learned that my alma mater, University of South Carolina, had an interesting time during Reconstruction. It was I didn't learn this when I was there, but it was during Reconstruction the only racially integrated public university in the South. I know you've written at length about this, but it didn't last long. But that is a part of our history. Claflin, where you teach, I know has its roots in Reconstruction. I mean, tell me some about that. The changes in education and higher education.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I first got to USC as a PhD student in 2012. I didn't know about that either. In fact, I learned about it when I worked with the African American Studies program, now department, when they were doing the then 50th anniversary of desegregation of USC. And what was funny was when they were talking about it amongst faculty and students in the program and affiliated people, it was always, well, this was the second desegregation. And I said, well, wait, what do you mean the second? And they will point out that in 1873, you had Black students and, worth noting, Black faculty at University of South Carolina, only for about 4 years or so. But like you just pointed out, that was the only state university in the South to even attempt that at the time. And again, there's so much that could be said about that history. That could be a whole podcast series unto itself, never mind an episode. But in the 1860s and 70s, you have a couple of things going on. You have USC desegregating briefly. A lot of white students leave the school, but some do actually stay. I think it's worth noting that, too. Some do actually stay and form lasting friendships with their Black counterparts. In fact, there are, if you read, and sorry for the shameless plug, but if you check out the book Invisible No More, The African American Experience, University of South Carolina, edited by myself and Tyler D. Perry, who's now at UNLV, we have chapters in there about the Reconstruction period and its aftermath. And one of the things that historians have found is that even into the early to mid 20th century, when USC would have alumni gatherings, they would invite some of those Black students, or at least make people aware that, yes, we have Black students. They kind of downplayed it for a long time. But that takes me to my second point, which is about Claflin. Claflin was founded in 1869. It's the oldest HBCU in South Carolina, although our good friends at Allen would argue with us about that for one very specific reason. Our creed, the founding creed of Claflin, says that we're open to everyone, regardless of race, creed, gender, etc. Allen, which was operated by the AME Church, was specifically for Black students from its founding in 1870. So there's that small caveat there. But Claflin was part of that first generation of what we now call historically Black colleges and universities. They were being founded all over the South in the aftermath of the Civil War. Your Howards, your Fisk, Allen, Benedict, so on and so forth. And what's important about that, you just mentioned Eric Foner. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention W.E.B. Du Bois. And in The Souls of Black Folk, he has chapters about the history of Black higher education. And he talks about that first generation of HBCUs. Depending on which version you read, he does mention Claflin directly by name. But what he points out is that first generation HBCUs were often liberal arts universities funded by New England abolitionists who were trying to help Black Americans lift themselves up after slavery and the Civil War and all that. But I think what's important to note is, I would just say a moment ago, no one could have imagined as late as, say, 1864, 65, that within a handful of years, you would have not only K through 12 schools, but schools of higher education that were welcoming Black students to them. That was very rare before the Civil War. And suddenly you have all these citadels of Black education being built throughout the South.
Yeah. I mean, Du Bois, I believe he taught at Fisk, right?
Yes, he did. In fact, in Souls of Black Folk, he talks about being a student at Fisk and later teaching at in Tennessee in the summertime and Georgia in the summertime. Du Bois was a New Englander. He was from Massachusetts. So going to Fisk was his first real experience with the South.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Reconstruction ended, because I think, you know, we're talking about some real bright spots in our history, but it was short-lived. You know, I feel like there's a cloud hanging over all this, which is that, you know, USC did not stay integrated for long in the 19th century. We entered a really dark time as a state in general after that. How did Reconstruction end, and how was that felt in South Carolina?
Wow, that is a really important question. And the thing about Reconstruction, as we were talking about a moment ago, is that it's very easy to simply say, oh, it was the reintegration of the Southern states into the Union. But by the mid-1870s, there was real political exhaustion in the North in dealing with Reconstruction, especially the violence in the region. I would really recommend to your listeners that they read some of the recent works on Reconstruction by, say, Godada Williams, for example, and others, where they really dive into the violence of the era. To give you an example of this, we've mentioned the 1868 Constitution and the previous year's convention. At the 1895 convention that was designed to essentially overturn that 1868 convention and what it had done for Black Americans, Robert Smalls, one of the few Black delegates at both conventions, he says in 1895, he estimated that up to 53,000 Black people had been killed during Reconstruction. And again, that's a rough estimate. We're not sure how accurate it is. But if you go back and read, for example, the 1870-71 Ku Klux Klan testimonies in Congress, the first time, by the way, Black people were invited to testify before Congress ever. The story,
and it was about the Klan.
Right. It was about the rise of the KKK as essentially a terrorist organization throughout the South that was trying to destroy Reconstruction. When you read the testimonies of Black men, women, and you know, families that were terrorized by the Klan, you get a real sense of how dangerous Reconstruction was throughout the South, especially in South Carolina. Again, to answer your question, I'm kind of taking the circuitous route really here, but bear with me for a second. In 1870, the Klan, which had been around since 1866, had become such a national problem that President Ulysses S. Grant signs what's known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, which is designed to target the Klan specifically. The Department of Justice is formed in part to fight the Ku Klux Klan. The state of South Carolina sees 9 of its counties, mostly in the upstate, placed under martial law. The U.S. Army, U.S. Marshals come in to restore order. Thousands of Klansmen either flee the state or go into hiding for several years. Only a handful of folks were actually ever arrested for that, but the Klan is effectively destroyed. Now, that's the good news. The bad news was that within a few years, you have white Southerners who were openly attacking Reconstruction without wearing masks, without hiding, without killing folks at night. They're killing folks now in broad daylight. The Colfax Massacre in Louisiana, the Battle of Liberty Place in New Orleans in 1874. You have examples of massacres all across the South. The Hamburg Massacre in South Carolina, 1876. And there's, thanks to a racism at the time, it was always kind of on shaky ground how many white and Northerners supported Reconstruction. But then the Panic of 1873 and the nation's national depression after that, it really pushed many white Northerners to just say, we really don't care about this that much. We are more focused on pocketbook issues. And so the momentum of Reconstruction is kind of lost. But even then, it depends on which state you're talking about. My home state of Georgia, Reconstruction was effectively over after 1870. Whereas in South Carolina, it lingers through 1876. That year, you have a disputed election on both a national level between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden, but on a state level between Republican Daniel Chamberlain, the incumbent governor, and Wade Hampton III, his Democratic challenger, where there's accusations of voter fraud, voter intimidation on both sides, and eventually a deal is reached on a national level to give the Republicans the presidency in exchange for pulling the last remaining troops out of the South for reinforcing Reconstruction. And be clear, when we tell this part of the story, it's important to note there were never that many federal troops in the South during Reconstruction. It wasn't like this massive occupying army, which is how it's often portrayed. It was only a handful of troops. Most of the army was actually busy out west fighting Native Americans at the same time Reconstruction is going on in the South. We shouldn't lose sight of that either. But Reconstruction comes to an end because of national political exhaustion, Republican Party kind of losing the will to enforce civil rights by the 1870s, and really abandoning the promises and hopes of Reconstruction. With all that said, even in South Carolina, you still have folks like Robert Smalls still being sent to Congress in the 1880s. And it's not really until the 1890s where black political power in the state and throughout the South is permanently broken, at least until the Civil Rights era.
And again, not to boil down history to individuals and their actions, but I always think about Pitchfork Ben Tillman as a figure sort of exemplary of the end of Reconstruction. What I understand of him, you know, he was a leader of one of those white terrorist organizations, the Red Shirts. I believe he took part in the Hamburg Massacre. You know, an unrepentant white supremacist who boasted about leading lynch mobs, who then found his way into the halls of power, was our governor, made his way to Congress, and played a role in rewriting the Constitution in 1895, which paved the way for Jim Crow. Is there anything else people should know? You know, like when you go to the State House and you see the statue of his legal first name was not Pitchfork, that was a nickname, but Ben Tillman. What should people know about that man?
Well, the first thing they should know is that I can't think of anyone who is less deserving of a statue in the State House grounds than Ben Tillman, which is saying a lot, because you see who's actually a statue in the State House grounds. There are some pretty disreputable folks there, but he is arguably the worst. And, you know, with Ben Tillman, you're right. He was involved. He boasted about his involvement with massacres during the Reconstruction. When he runs for governor in 1890s, he is explicitly clear that he's running on a white supremacist platform. Now, I think your listeners were thinking, well, it's 1890s. Wasn't everybody doing that? I often joke with my students, whether it's a Claflin or Justice Simpkins school, you know someone is really racist when white people at the time are like, this guy is racist. And Ben Tillman is the example of that. He admits when he pushes for the 1895 convention to create a new state constitution, he admits publicly that his chief goal is to disenfranchise black voters. And he says, if this involves also disenfranchising white voters, then so be it. They got to keep in mind, that constitution could not explicitly say, we are stripping black men of the right to vote, thanks to the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution, which guarantee national citizenship and guarantee the right to vote regardless of race. So they would do other things like, say, if you were found guilty of certain crimes, or you hadn't paid your poll tax, or you couldn't pass literacy tests. Those were methods they used to disenfranchise thousands of black voters. But at the same time, they admitted, we're going to also disenfranchise white voters too. This is why there's this period, you just asked about Reconstruction. There's this period from 1890 until 1910 where the Southern states are all revising their Reconstruction era constitutions to enshrine a new order of white supremacy that destroys the black vote. And in the process, they make the South the least small d democratic part of the country. Voting rates across the South plummet by the early 20th century because of not only black voters losing their right to vote, but also many white voters too. And so I think Ben Tillman plays a pivotal role in using that strategy of both violence and political intimidation, often referred to as the Mississippi Plan, because it was drawn from Mississippi in the 1870s, to really break the back of black political power in the state. With that said, Tillman is also a rather interesting figure for a variety of other reasons. Again, he was an ardent white supremacist who was actually criticized on the floor of the Senate for giving these staunchly pro-lynching speeches, where folks were disgusted by what he was saying about trying to disenfranchise the black voters of South Carolina.
Yeah, always a good reminder that even by the standards of his time, some people found him repellent. This was not even within the bounds of common decency back then. And yeah, I just think about, you know, the way you lay out Reconstruction, it starts with this rapid expansion of democracy and ends with the rapid contraction of it by design. I'm gonna fast forward through some history here because, you know, we talked about Reconstruction. The civil rights movement of the mid-20th century is sometimes referred to as our country's second Reconstruction, when, again, we had a real struggle that resulted in rapid expansion of the franchise and of democracy and of rights for all. You wrote a piece, and I'm sorry to bring this up, I didn't prepare you, but you wrote something in 2023 in The Nation, Why the United States Needs a New Reconstruction. And, you know, there's this notion that our country could have a third Reconstruction if we wanted it, but what that would look like today and how we would go about it would have to be different. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could kind of share your thoughts on that. Like, what could a third Reconstruction look like today, and how would we even get there?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that essay because it was written, as you mentioned, 2023, and I think now 3 years later, it's more necessary than ever before. I think one way it would look is it would have to come with a full accounting with our past, for one. I mentioned W.B. Du Bois a moment ago. Of course, he is arguably best known, depending on who you ask, for writing the book Black Reconstruction in America, which was one of the earliest attempts to overturn what's known as the Dunning School of Reconstruction, which argued that Reconstruction was a disaster, it was a failure, it showed black people were capable of democracy. Du Bois says that's all nonsense, and here's 700 pages to prove why it's nonsense. I think one of the things we have to do right now is reckon with the fact that we have an administration in the White House right now that is trying to, again, overturn history. They're trying to change the lessons we've learned from that, whether it's condemning certain exhibits at the Smithsonian, whether it's overturning the original renaming of military bases, things like that. So we have to reckon with our history in an honest and forthright manner. But beyond that, we have to also reckon with the fact that each previous Reconstruction, the first one in the 1860s, the second one in the 1960s, they came so close to really dealing with these problems, but there were always things left incomplete. For example, during the first Reconstruction, women not getting the right to vote. During the second Reconstruction, issues of labor and human rights not quite being debated in a forthright manner by 1967-68. You think about Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign. I think that's a good distillation we're talking about. This idea of we should take resources being devoted to militarism and imperialism and refocus them on fighting poverty in a real manner, not just threadbare. So I think the biggest thing we have to do right now is we have to reprioritize things as a country, not just moving away from militarism and imperialism, but really asking some serious, deep, searching questions about what should the average American's life look like in 2026? Because what we're doing right now is clearly not working for most people. Finally, I would say with a new reconstruction, it has to be more inclusive. It has to include everyone in the idea of what it means to be an American, whether you're regardless of your race, creed, immigration status or background and so forth. In other words, it's going to take, as Dr. King called it, a revolution of values. The first reconstruction was perhaps the closest the country ever came to really reevaluating what its values actually were, because it wasn't just about we have to save the Union, we have to solve the issues of post-slavery America. It's we have to stand as an example of democracy in a time, the 1860s, where there were very few other democracies in the world. So everyone was watching what was going to happen in America. That's still the case in 2026.
It's a tall order, but I think you're right. There is a conscious effort to erase and change the history we learn. And then there are very real efforts that we're contending with every day to erode our rights and erode sort of beginnings of democracy that we have here. Yeah, this is all great food for thought. I'm really grateful to you for your work. Like I've said this before, but your writing has really helped me think deeply about our state and its role in the expansion and contraction of freedom. And really appreciate you coming on the show today. If people want to find your work, you know, your writing, your teaching, where can they find you?
Well, I'm not hard to find. I am on Instagram. I am on Threads as ROGreen86. I can also be found on the artist formerly known as Twitter as well. And I can basically be found online pretty easily. Of course, I teach at Clough University. I'm the lead instructor of the Modesto Simpkin School, and I'm the podcast co-host for Our New South as well. So I am not hard to find at all.
I think we've alluded to it, but not actually explained. What is the Modesto Simpkin School? What do you do there?
So that school, it's been around since 2015, and it's part of the South Carolina Progressive Network. And what the school has done is it teaches people who are curious about history, what we call the real unvarnished history of South Carolina. It's a grassroots people's history of the Palmetto State. And the purpose of the school is not just to teach history, although that's very important. It's also to make folks better engaged citizens and better informed activists. Many of our graduates go on to get involved in activism, number of organizations and causes. Even those who don't are still heavily engaged with the school years after they graduate. And it's named for Modesto Simpkins, who is one of the great activists and human rights activists from South Carolina. You talk about, again, an example of Reconstruction. I think Miss Simpkins is a good example of that. She was born in 1899, passed away in 1992. And during the 20th century, she was involved in virtually every major human rights campaign that the nation ever witnessed. And so our school is an attempt to distill her lessons and her teachings to a way that doesn't dumb it down. Like people joke that it's a graduate level course in history. And it's actually meant to be engaging, interactive, enjoyable, but above all, informative. And so we're doing our current session right now for 2026. We also, by the way, host deeper dives on Sundays, usually on Zoom. Those are open to the public. Anybody can attend those. The school itself, you have to apply to it. You have to pay tuition for it. But the deeper dives are open to everyone. And we're hoping to do more of those in the future.
Well, I'll include links to all this, your social media, your podcasts, the Modesto Simpkin School in the show notes. But again, thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful. Any chance to talk Reconstruction, I'll take it.
Same. So, Jace, the next time I bring up some Reconstruction trivia at a staff meeting, you're going to know who to blame, and it's Dr. Robert Greene II. It's his fault. So, while we have an audience here who listens all the way to the end of a podcast.
Love them.
Are there any? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sticking with us. We really appreciate y'all. And because we have such attentive people here at the end, is there anything you want to mention about our work lately? You know, anything you'd want to highlight about just the latest at the ACLU of South Carolina?
You know, whenever I talk to or think about the work of university professors like Dr. Robert Greene II, I think about the attacks that we've seen on speech by academics. And we just filed a lawsuit right in the line here. So Dr. Emily Taylor is a professor at Presbyterian College, a private school in Clinton, South Carolina. And she's an English and women's studies professor. And, you know, after Charlie Kirk was killed, she wrote what I would consider a scholarly article. I'm not a scholar myself, but it certainly was a scholarly article, in my opinion, about masculinity, toxic masculinity, violence. And when some legislators learned about it, they threatened the college. And they, because it's a private college, they couldn't threaten actual like funding in the state budget. So what they threatened was scholarship money, a direct threat toward the students who are given scholarships like the Life Scholarship or you know, need-based scholarships, threatened that money. And Dr. Taylor ended up resigning so that students would not lose their scholarship funds. And we filed a lawsuit against those legislators who essentially are using their political positions to threaten a private institution to retaliate against their employee for that employee's speech. It is not okay. This is absolutely something that we had to, when we learned about it, we had to take this case because we have to let lawmakers know this is not okay. It is unconstitutional. The First Amendment, you know, will not allow for this. And so I'm, you know, listening to Dr. Greene II really makes me think about how many professors right now are worried that something could happen to them, like has happened to Dr. Taylor, like has happened to Dr. Breggy, another professor that we have worked with, and hundreds of professors all over this country who have been fired, who have been forced to resign due to political mobs violating their free speech. And so really glad that we have Dr. Taylor who's willing to fight back. And really glad, of course, we have Dr. Greene II as well, given his work, and hope that he certainly hasn't experienced what many in his industry have been experiencing lately.
I got to talk to Dr. Taylor a little bit about just her case, her story. I'm really grateful to her for her work and her willingness to, you know, take this challenge to court. It's a lot. She's been through a lot. And, you know, she's a first-generation college student who got into the profession in part to teach kids who were just like she was growing up. It's a real loss. And, you know, we've heard from fellow faculty members and students at the college who miss her. And it's a real shame when the state comes after people who are serving their community in the way that she does. So if people want to read more about this case, just go to our website. It's aclusc.org. We've got something about it on the homepage right now. But yeah, that's such a bread and butter ACLU case. We're talking about free speech. This is a kind of case we have to take on.
You got it. Yeah. We can't let politicians silence anyone. That's not what we do here.
If you liked this episode, dear listeners, please tell your friends, tell your family, your cousins, your enemies, your Facebook friends, tell anybody, check this podcast out. Leave a nice review on whichever podcast platform you use. That helps spread the word. And yeah, just thank you for listening. As always, thank you to Daft Hartley and A Spot on the Hill for the use of their music on today's show.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, while I breathe, I hope.